I'm Chuck Osborne.
And I'm Michael Smith. Welcome to our podcast, which is presented by Assured Partners Investment Advisors,
where we talk investing and all things related in a way you can understand.
Woohoo!
Chuck.
Hey, and this is Michael. It is March 10th, 2025. It's the 17th episode of our podcast. You might notice, that's right, we don't want to lose that.
Here we go.
You might notice some changes. We've got some new digs. We're doing the podcast in a new spot. We're also, you see, we're doing a split screen here. We're trying to be more topical and current with the podcast to talk about things that are going on in the moment a little bit more. And with that in mind, Chuck, what's on your mind?
America First is not working out, Michael. As of this morning, international markets are up 10.64% year to date, and the S&P 500 is down 1.66, and we are dropping fast. So far, the rest of the world is loving this America First thing.
Yeah, the narrative's starting off on the wrong foot, it would feel like.
It certainly seems so. So I don't know. Maybe I know Trump's a big golfer. The low score wins in golf. So maybe that's what he's thinking.
It's backwards. Yeah. Let's talk about why what we think's going on here. It's a multifaceted answer. It's not one thing. But right. Why don't you start off with what you think maybe be the driving piece, and let's get into the details of it.
Well, the elephant in the room, of course, is the tariffs. Yeah. And trade policy, and that's, you know, something we've got to talk about. In other words, in fairness, you know, we're kidding around, but in fairness, as we have said before, the economy and the market is actually bigger and stronger than any administration or anything else. And when we entered this year, the U.S. stock market was extremely expensive, and the rest of the world wasn't cheap, but they were average. You know, they're kind of priced averagely. So it shouldn't be a surprise that those stocks are actually doing better than U.S. stocks year to date. But it's only been spurred on by the trade wars that we have decided to start.
Yeah, right. So we were between 90 and 95th most expensive. The S&P has been in the last 20 years, so very expensive. International markets, yeah, relatively average. So, yeah, everyone knew this could happen, and all you needed, because we say all the time, valuation doesn't actually do anything. It's not a trigger on its own, but you start having trade issues, and this is the kind of thing the market can use as a trigger to revert to the mean, and it looks like it's potentially starting now.
Yeah, absolutely. It is certainly triggered. The market has, year to date so far, it has rotated pretty heavily towards international stocks and away from the U.S.
Yeah. So,
which is not surprising when you go down the policy path that we've decided to go down, where we're doing tariffs and it looks like they're actually going to do it. You know, I think a lot of the people, ourselves included, at least myself included, thought that this was all bluster and negotiating. And, you know, Trump is, you know, he's going ahead. We're not putting tariffs. Well, in fairness, I guess he did put tariffs on China, you know, another 20%, you know, 2-10% increments there. But he's mostly attacking our neighbors and friends, you know, in Mexico and Canada, who are two of our largest trade partners, obviously, because of being so close by.
Yeah. And before, you know, right at the beginning of the administration, not that they're very far into it, the big worry was, oh, this could be this could cause inflation. And so the big economic worry was, are we going to hit inflation? Now, what's happened is the market has switched, it seems, to be a little bit more worried about a growth scare. So. Yep. Let's get into that a little bit about tariffs, what they actually do, and why that potentially may make sense a little bit.
Sure. And we wrote about that. If for our listeners who also, you know, read the stuff that we put out, I felt like it was very intellectually lazy for people to be saying that tariffs are going to cause inflation. And the reason is, and this may be deeper than we want to get into, but you've got to understand how prices are actually developed and discovered, really, because that's what companies have to do. They have to discover the price that they can actually sell their product at, which is both profitable to them and will hopefully maximize their, you know, their efficiency as a company. And the truth is that, you know, manufacturing companies, and that's primarily who are getting hit by these tariffs, whether they're here or overseas, they do not have the ability to just raise their prices by 25%. If they did, they would have already done it.
Yeah, the market won't bear it.
Right. The market will not bear that. If they raise the prices by 25%, in other words, just price in this entire, Trump tariff and try to pass it on, what's going to happen is they're going to sell much less of their, you know, whatever they're selling. And the and that's not going to be good for anyone. So what really happens in the tariff situation is that you do get a slowdown in growth, you know. And the last time we went down this road, which everyone thought would be the last time in history, was, you know, 1930 in Smoot-Hawley, which was largely credited for creating the Great Depression, if not at least making it much worse.
I would argue making it much worse. I mean, you already had, the market had already fallen. You already had significant
economic damage. Right, you had the crash in 29. But it was certainly a major trigger.
It would hurt. Every economist I've ever seen across the board says it made it considerably worse any way you look at it. And extended it and made it much longer than it needed to be.
I mean, there's a long history there. So, you know, one of the questions, you know, we have is, does Trump even have the power to create tariffs? Because in the Constitution, that's not given to the president. That's given to Congress. And, you know, we've had a slow moving through the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century here to give the president more and more power over this, largely because of that bill, which got through Congress. And, you know, what happens, though, in the Depression, and this is the point that I really wanted to make, was that you actually have a deflationary environment, not an inflationary environment.
Yeah. It's the opposite.
Right. It is the opposite. So the opposite. What you have is you've got a incentive to there'll be fewer units demanded. You know, that's what happens with supply and demand. When you raise prices just kind of arbitrarily, then people are going to demand less of your product. And so that's going to drive down demand. At the same time, because you're not going to be able to pass these costs along, then that makes it less attractive to the manufacturer to continue to make the product. And so that is going to reduce supply. So you have both a reduction in supply and a reduction in demand. And that tends to be deflationary and lead to recessions and depressions, not growth and inflation.
And so all else equal, it's just a negative growth impulse. And then, you know, what happens in the actual economy, right? So the Atlanta Fed does a thing called GDP Now, which takes current inputs of all the inputs that would go into your GDP calculation, which is investment, consumption, government spending, and net exports. And as that data comes out on a quarterly basis, they update that. So you have a running total of, in the moment, what is the current GDP growth look like? And we got to kind of smacked in the face a little bit. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you could call it it. It was a smackdown. So we were at positive 2.3% growth just, you know, 10 days ago. That was what GDP Now was showing. And then we went to negative 2.8. Now, it has since been revised to negative 2.4, which is, you know, slightly better or less bad. But almost all of that, if not all of that, is because of international trade. And that's something that you got to also understand. So imports are subtracted out of GDP. And there's a very good reason for that. So GDP is your gross domestic product, and domestic being the key word here. We're trying to measure what's actually created in the U.S. economy. The biggest input to that is consumption, is personal consumption. You know, we, as everyone knows, you know, 70% of the U.S. economy in particular is consumer. It's what we buy. And so if we go to the, our family has bought two new cars, but they're both American made. So this doesn't count. But we'll say we went to the Toyota dealer and purchased a car, then, you know, that would be counted in GDP. The problem, though, is that that car is not made in the United States. It's made in Japan. And we don't want that to count in GDP one way or the other. So the only way we could take care of that is to then subtract out the import of that car. And so that is an important thing to understand, because what happens is a lot of people that have, you know, just a surface level knowledge of how GDP is calculated will suggest that, well, you know, imports are a negative on GDP. That means imports are bad, that somehow it's bad to import things. The truth is imports are neither bad nor good as far as GDP is concerned. They don't have any impact at all. But the only way to not count them as part of GDP is to subtract them out, because they are part of the consumption in the GDP calculation. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you don't want to count it twice.
Right. You don't want it, because if you don't want to count it twice, and you don't, and you can't also just not count it. You can't just ignore it because it's already in there. When people go to purchase that product, whether it's, use our example, like a Toyota vehicle made in Japan comes over to the United States, we buy it. Now, there is part of that purchase is U.S. GDP, so it's a local dealer. You know, the salesperson gets a commission. All of that goes into GDP, but the car itself wasn't made here, so we don't want to count that as part of U.S. GDP.
Yeah.
And so that's why we subtract it out. And what we suspect happened is that because of the scare of tariffs, we have a lot of people that have kind of front-loaded their international demand. They're trying to get their products here before the tariffs take effect. Yeah. And so there was a huge upsurge in imports.
Yeah, and there's also there's this weird influx of imported gold from Switzerland, which the Atlanta Fed talked about and said, this is a one-off strange thing. It shouldn't even go in the calculation. So when they adjusted for that, they said the real impact is probably we're moving to a 0.4% growth rate, all else equal. So what does that mean? It's still a huge pull down. It's not way into negative. So that probably was overstretched a bit. But the point is still the same. You probably have a little bit of a negative, push to growth here. Tariffs can make that worse. There's worry there. And so it happens to spark fear. And so there's fear hitting the market. At this point, probably more about what can be than actually the data that's happening, but still that's what's happening a bit.
Well, right, because I think the real fear in the market, I think what's happened so far is that you've got things that may have been purchased all throughout the year that just got pushed forward because people were afraid of tariffs. And so, it's not the amount of imports that have come in have not sustainable. As you mentioned, a lot of it was gold. And that just has to do with people wanting to put money in gold, probably to protect against inflation.
Yeah.
We could talk about whether that's a good idea or not, but
different podcasts on that one.
that is a different podcast, but at any rate, the real worry in the market is the growth hit from, a 25% tax on foreign consumption.
Yeah.
And it's not even just foreign consumption, because and this is one of the reasons why the administration keeps having to create loopholes, or at least temporary loopholes. The way the Chevy and Ford build cars nowadays, that is a car that's ultimately built in the United States, but it goes across the Canadian and/or Mexican border like eight times. before it's actually fully constructed, because you know parts are coming from everywhere. They do certain things in certain factories and other things in other factories, and that's just the way that our economy has evolved. And you know, what would that do to the price of a car? You know, there, you've seen estimates on a Ford truck; it could be as much as an $8,000 increase. You know, in what it is already a very expensive,
expensive automobile. Yeah.
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 So. Well,
yeah.
Yeah, that's not sustainable.
No. Well, what we're really getting here is to more deep is the idea of the trade deficit and the yeah. current administration's focus on the trade deficit and how terrible that is. It's a very contentious subject in economic circles, frankly. But I think it gets vilified a little bit.
Right.
You know,
well,
if you look at a trade deficit, it's hard to look at the U.S. and say we're in a worse space than all these people that are running surpluses against us from the economic perspective.
Well, it's interesting. I think so much of this is the language, and I don't know. I mean, who it was that decided that when we import more and export less, that's called a deficit, and when we do the opposite, it's referred to as a surplus. I do actually understand why that is. It has to do with your kind of foreign accounts, but it's really misleading, I think, to the layperson, because in reality, you just think of it as simply as this, because this is really as simple as it is. If you have a trade deficit, it means you have gotten more and given less. You know, so you are getting more for less. And as you know, Michael, one of the ways I always think about, if you want to really understand the macro economy or like the entire economy of the United States, it is nothing more or less than all of our micro economies put together. So you take this down to an individual basis and you just ask yourself, I mean, of all the stuff that you consume, how much of it do you actually create yourself? I would say that most of us probably run a pretty large personal trade deficit. You know, we are actually getting more than what we are than what we're delivering as far as actual products and services. Okay, and and I think that's the way most people want it. And what you see is that this happens. The more affluent people are, the more they start hiring other people to do things for them. You know, it's like one of the first steps, and we've seen it like in our neighborhood. When I first moved into our neighborhood, there was one yard man that did a few houses in our neighborhood. Most of the people in our neighborhood, ourselves included, did our own yard work. We mowed our own yard. We have been in that neighborhood now for, 15 years. And over that time period, there are fewer and fewer people who are mowing their own yard. You know, as the prices of the houses in our neighborhood have gone up, as the level of affluence of the people in the neighborhood has gone up, there are fewer people mowing their own yards. And that is just what happens in an affluent society. And, you know, to your point, if you look at the countries that have huge trade surpluses, you're talking about places like China, Japan, Germany, you know, and really none of those places are better. Certainly not. You're not better off living in China or Japan.
Economically, not better in any place in there.
Yeah, no.
Standard living has gone down. Not necessarily in China if you're emerging, but if you're talking about developed countries, generally standards of living haven't kept up with our standards of living.
No, exactly. And I think this is where Trump gets it wrong. I think, you know, he believes that when we have a trade deficit, it means we're losing. You know, and this is something about him that he believes life is kind of a zero-sum game. So there's winners and losers. And he, you know, he talks that way. He defines things that way. And we could argue about whether that's correct or not. But I do think that's his view. And the what he doesn't seem to understand is when it comes to trade, the people who are running the trade deficits are the winners. It's not the other way around. And which is why we have been better off actually having freer trade than many of the people we trade with.
So there are some issues, though. One thing I'd always like, I'd like your take on is, you know, you see data points like non-college educated wages have been wildly stagnant, right? And historically in the 50s and 60s and even in the 70s, those people that went into those manufacturing jobs, that was a step up into middle class. And some of the service jobs that have replaced that people have done are, you know, they're not as good paying. And it's a very wide issue there. But it does seem to be that there is a hollowing out of the middle class that has happened in some ways. And some of that is being placed, maybe not for fair, on this kind of an issue. Like, what is your thought on that?
Right. So, well, ultimately what that goes into is, I think you could talk about how many, like, manufacturing jobs are there. All right. And this is data from the St. Louis Fed. It's a little bit dated. They ran this, you know, about, I don't know, not about 8 years ago, I think. But they tracked the percentage of real GDP, so inflation-adjusted GDP of manufacturing in the economy. And since 1947, it has ranged from 13.6 to 11.3%. So the range is actually very small. Now we are on the smaller end of that range now. We peaked, it peaked twice. It peaked in the mid-50s, 1955, which makes total sense. That was right after World War II. We were the only manufacturing powerhouse in the world that was still in one piece. And we were a leader in manufacturing. It also peaked in the late 70s, and then it has been, you know, again, it hasn't fluctuated much. It's only fluctuated 2%.
Yeah.
But the reality is it's very flat, and yeah. We are still manufacturing stuff in the United States. I know that goes against the narrative, but that is the truth.
Well, the number of jobs, which you can talk through that, is down pretty meaningfully. I mean,
the number of jobs is down dramatically. But the reason why it's important to understand that we aren't really manufacturing anything less is because, you know, it's the same thing if you look at agriculture. The number of jobs in agriculture is a tiny fraction of what it used to be. If you go back to the, you know, if you want to go back to the 19th and certainly the 18th, century, most people in America lived on farms, and that is no longer the case and has not been the case for several generations. And but we are still the world's breadbasket. We still produce more than almost anybody else in the world agriculturally. It's because what happens if you go out to the Midwest and you see these gigantic farms out there that go for miles and miles and miles, and you will see unmanned, you know, John Deere tractors out there plowing the crops. And, you know, the efficiency that has occurred from a technology standpoint is absolutely amazing. And then, of course, people left the farm and went into manufacturing jobs. And then the same thing has happened in manufacturing. For the reality is most manufacturing jobs have been replaced by technology and not by foreign competition. Now, you know, there's going to be someone listening who, you know, is, you know, in Michigan or Ohio or someplace, and they're going to say, wait a second, the factory in my town shut down and we lost all those jobs and it went to Mexico or it went, you know, somewhere. And yes, there are, you know, there are going to be anecdotal exceptions of that. But when you look at the United States as a whole, what's actually happened in manufacturing is that most of manufacturing in the United States used to be in what we refer to as the Rust Belt up in the, you know, upper Midwest. Most of those, and they have been hurt dramatically. It has moved largely to the Southeast. You know, so for every factory that you can point to in the Midwest that is shut down, you've got, you know, BMW, which has a plant in Greenville, South Carolina. You've got Mercedes and Porsche that are just south of here in Atlanta. You've got Kia in Alabama. You've got, I mean, there is all these facilities happening in the Southeast. Anyone in our neck of the woods who might drive from Atlanta to Savannah, there is, I mean, it's like they're building like a city outside of Savannah. Yeah. That is a large manufacturing facility that I believe is primarily for Kia. There are lots of manufacturing jobs happening. They're not happening in the places that they used to happen.
Yeah. Well, and they're different. I mean, there was a time in our history when Apple, you know, whatever's a new product, but whatever the Apple phone at the time of would have been made in the United States, right? There are these times where large things would have been done here. There's growth that happened in manufacturing, but the truth of the matter is manufacturing numbers of jobs in the last 20 years have been shrinking pretty much everywhere as automation is taking hold. I mean, you see it in China. There's still a ton of manufacturing jobs in China, but they've probably lost 20 million in the last 20 years because they're automating as well. But they still have 80 million. Right. So, yeah.
I mean, this is the evolution of economies and how economies change over time. And the thing that never bodes well for a country is when you try to hold on to the past or try to recreate the past.
Yeah. Yeah,
and as you know, as romantic as we might be about the past, that it just isn't a recipe for future success.
Yeah,
it is not going to bring about great success.
Yeah,
and you know, so that's I mean, that's where we are with I think with that now. I would argue that it's a slightly different issue with the non-college educated, salaries. Part of that is because we've had too many people, frankly, going to college. And, you know, that sounds bad, but the idea that every single person has to go to college is just not right. And that has caused issues within the university system in of itself, in which we've written about many times. But there are plenty of good paying jobs that don't actually require a college education. So one of the things that we should talk about, especially because it's one of our best clients, is in the transportation business. So one of the things that trade spurs is that there's a lot of jobs in terms of stevedoring jobs, where people are loading and unloading ships. There's the transportation, taking these large ocean tankers up riverways and into ports where their cargo can be unloaded and then they can be reloaded. There's a lot of those types of jobs that do not require college education and actually pay very well. And those jobs are created because of trade, and those jobs are going to be, you know, threatened. And that's one of the things when you start putting in tariffs, one of the big problems is that you start picking winners and losers. So you're supposedly trying to protect certain jobs, like steel is one of the favorite things. And Trump's already done this. George W. Bush did it. There's been, you know, several times presidents have tried to protect the steel industry in the United States. And what happens when you do that is, okay, maybe you do save some jobs in the steel industry, but now the cost of steel has gone up dramatically, and that hurts the auto industry. And that hurts every other industry that actually uses steel. And there's a lot more jobs in the United States in all those other industries combined than there are in just steel. And so you have a situation where the government starts picking winners and losers, and that's not good.
Yeah, well, you know, when tariffs were put on washing machines, there was a lot of Trump put tariffs on washing machines, and they were actually able to go in and look what happened. And I'm not exactly right about that, but they think that the cost of each additional washing machine and total output loss was something like $816,000 by doing that, right? So they, right. It really had a majorly negative impact on the economy. I mean, it, you know, it wasn't large enough to hit the whole thing, but it was a negative impact by doing this. If you looked at all the externalities together, there's hard to say that it helped in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think the one last thing that I would just mention is the difference between Trump 2.0 and Trump 1.0 is that, you know, when he first got elected, he still had the same attitude towards trade, and he was wanting to put in tariffs. Then they were more targeted specifically to China. But he did that after doing tax and regulatory reform, which were two huge positives with, you know, in terms of stimulating the economy and growth in the economy. And with the tax and regulatory reform that he was able to get through through Congress, and then, well, a lot of the regulatory reform he did by his own pen, but the tax reform went through Congress. He basically was, you know, took our GDP up to almost 4%, which economists didn't think was possible at the time. And then when he started the trade war after that, it took a full percentage point off GDP, and we dropped back down. But it was still higher than what we had been doing previously to his administration. So I think part of the problem right now, too, is the order in which they are attacking their agenda. You know, if you look at the Trump economic agenda, you've got two big positives and one big negative, in my view. And the two big positives are his views on regulations and taxes and wanting to reform those. The negative is his, in my opinion, a misunderstanding of international trade. And that's going to have a negative impact on the economy. And that is what he has chosen to lead off with this time. And so I think that has that could run into issues.
Well, I'm going to tell you that I've mentioned this to you before, but this weekend, this idea has really come to a head in kind of the investing world out in Twitter in places is
right.
This view that this is being done on purpose. And this is a bit of a conspiracy theory, but we're doing a podcast, so let's get spicy about it a little bit. But this view that's being done on purpose, apparently Volcker walked into Nixon's office when he first started. Now, he was not the secretary at the time, but told him, you should take a recession early in your career because at that point, I mean, earlier in your presidency, because right now at that moment, inflation was already going from 4.7 to 5.5 and was already starting to rear its head. That was before the real big problems happened. But that's being talked about right now. And what's being commented on is this idea that this is like a Volcker moment, which means pushing into a recession, not doing the good things that you could do on the economy right now, causing a recession to happen early in the presidency that could lower inflation, get a lot of these things in check, and then you still have chance to grow out of that and have a good long-term, you know, economy by the time you get around to midterms and all these things. And it's very conspiracy sounding, but it's really, it seems to be a pretty big narrative that's playing in markets right now, causing, you know.
Yeah. How did that work out for Biden?
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, you know, Biden came in and, you know, he did the big stimulus, which was their dream package, even though his own economists were telling him not to do it, that it was going to cause inflation. He drove us into a recession. I know they didn't call it a recession, but we actually had a recession in 2022 after he inherited an economy that was growing at 6%. And of course, he had a huge spike in inflation. And the reality was inflation kept getting better. But he still got blamed for that. And frankly, rightfully so. And that did not work out for him. So I'm not so sure that strategy is going to work.
Well, if that's real, and I'm not saying it is.
If that's real,
it's dangerous because recessions are dangerous. and they're hard to play. It's economics, all of these things, there's a psychology to it. It's not just math. It's not like you put an input like people think it is and the economy does this. That's not how that works. And you get unintended consequences from thinking that you can control these things.
Yeah, you can't control it. And mm-hmm. If history shows us is that the countries and the administrations that attempt to control it are the ones that end up making things worse. We almost always make it worse. And it's very counterintuitive. I think this is one of the reasons why intellectuals always hate capitalism, because they think they should be smart enough to control things. And the truth is, you're better off not trying to control it. You're better off letting nature take its course. And then, of course, having the social safety net and programs in place to protect, you know, anyone that, you know, if they do get hurt. But that has always been the recipe for success economically. And whether, you know, the last administration made the mistake of thinking that they could just spend money, you know, willy-nilly, and they had some economists who were telling them that they could do that, and it wasn't going to actually cause inflation, that real economists were wrong for years. And, you know, now we've got kind of a reverse, the flip side of the same coin, where there you've got a couple economists, if you want to call them that, in the White House who think that tariffs are a wonderful thing and that protectionism is a wonderful thing, and that real economists have been wrong for years, and they're not wrong. So yeah. They weren't wrong, you know, about spending. They're not wrong about tariffs. We're always better off when we allow for more freedom as opposed to less freedom.
But the takeaway from all this, in my opinion, is, yes, regardless of the conspiracy theory side, it's potentially that we could have some economic weakness here if we have to have a little bit of austerity at the end of the game. But long term, if we can actually get expenses and things like that controlled some, and if you could do some solid things on the regulatory side, there's a reason to think that there's a positive outcome if, you know, if the administration doesn't do, you know, doesn't make too many mistakes here.
Well, I think that may be, we may be getting into a different subject for a different podcast, Michael, but which would be a good conversation. Obviously there are gains to be had in the Trump playbook if he does go down the deregulation and the tax reform path that he did in his first administration. Those were the things that stimulated the economy and made the economy so good that everyone remembers. The tariff path, there's no coming back from. The only way we come back from the tariff path is if tariffs don't actually happen. Which may be the case. You know, this may still be all negotiating posturing. We'll have to wait and see. But if to the extent that tariffs do get implemented, it is going to cause a slowdown in growth. It is going to hurt us in the United States. It is not going to help us. And we used to know this. I mean, this is basically, you know, why we had that big Tea Party in Boston way back when that led to, the revolution. We used to understand that when government put tariffs on imported goods, it was not a good thing. So hopefully, the one thing is for sure is Trump he is not slow to fire people if he changes his mind. And, you know, maybe if we do see the negative impacts, like you say, maybe, you know, he will wisen up and he will tell Mr. Navarro that you're fired, just like an episode of The Apprentice. And we can get some real economists in there advising him, and we could, you know, reverse course on this.
Yep.
You know, and so hopefully that works. And at the very least, hopefully we get to the actual more positive parts of this platform economically, and that would be very good.
Yep. So. All right. Well, I think that's what we got for today.
I think so.
All right. Good seeing everybody. As always, we're going to be back on a normal, you know, monthly at least schedule here of getting back into the podcast. And so if you want to hear about anything, reach out and let us know your thoughts.
All right.
Thanks.
Sounds good.
Chuck Osborne and Michael Smith are investment advisors, representative of Assured Partners Investment Advisors, LLC, a registered investment advisor. All statements and opinions expressed in this program are based upon information considered reliable, although statements or opinions are subject to change without notice. Information expressed does not consider the specific situation or objectives of any person and is not intended as a recommendation appropriate for any person. Viewers are encouraged to seek advice from a tax or legal professional or investment advisor to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation. Information presented is for educational purposes only and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. Investments involve risk, and unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed.